I'm here today with Robert Kirkpatrick, Director of UN Global Pulse. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Robert. I wonder if we could begin, if you could briefly explain for our listeners, what is big data and what is UN Global Pulse? We're particularly interested in hearing more about your strategy of combining research and practical field-based pulse labs. So why have you chosen this strategy and what are you hoping to achieve as Global Pulse?
Sure. So big data is a term that's come into vogue only in the last couple of years, and it refers to the tremendous explosion in volume and velocity and variety of digital data that is being produced around the world. The statistics are somewhat astonishing. There was more data produced in 2011 alone than in all of the rest of human history combined back to the invention of the alphabet. This data is digital in nature. It is the data that is produced as people buy and sell goods, as they search for information, as they browse the web, as they share, you know, their day-by-day experiences with friends and family on social networks. And this data is already being used by the private sector to transform how they make decisions, how they understand their customers, how they identify new markets, and how they track their own operations. So we began to ask at Global Pulse, how can we use this data to understand when people are getting sick, when they're losing their jobs, when they're struggling to afford food or medicine. Global Pulse is an initiative that came out of the global financial crisis, at which point there was a recognition that we now live in this hyper-connected world where, you know, information moves at the speed of light and a crisis can be all around the world very, very quickly, but we're still using 2 to 3 year old statistics to make most policy decisions. The irony is we're swimming in this ocean of digital data, which is being produced for free all around us. And so Global Pulse is essentially an R&D lab for the UN system. We're focused on three objectives. One, learning how to harness it for development. Two, building free and open source tools that help practitioners do that. And then three, supporting mainstream adoption of these approaches into policymaking. Our strategy is to form global partnerships with the organizations that have the data, the technology, and the human expertise to do this analysis. So that means private sector, it means academia. And at the same time, it is to take this work to the field, to the country level, on the ground in developing countries, to try out new approaches. So we're launching labs where data scientists and engineers and policy experts work side by side on R&D projects to learn how to take this forward.
So a lot of your work investigates the role of real-time data in development. And I wonder, could you give us some examples of how real-time data has already contributed practically to the fight against poverty, hunger, and disease? Or indeed, speak a little bit about your own proof of concept projects that you initially carried out, or cases that have already been seen to really have an impact?
Well, a lot of this data is so new that even the private sector, which is the source of much of the data, is still struggling to learn how to use it. I think if we list poverty, hunger, and disease, the area where the greatest evidence of efficacy has already been obtained is really in the area of health. There have been tremendous demonstrations that, you know, when people get sick, their behavior online changes. They search for their symptoms on Google. They share their symptoms and their own hypothesis about what's affecting them through social media. I think, you know, there's been a lot of use, for example, in showing how population movements in areas where there is a pandemic underway can be used to project where the pandemic will be spread to next. So we've seen huge evidence that essentially health-related human behavior change creates digital echoes that can be used both to track what's happening and predict what's going to happen next. In food security, in poverty, this is still a fairly untested area, but we've done some research, for example, in Indonesia, where we showed that we can begin to approximate the consumer price index for basic foodstuffs by looking at keywords and online mood related to food through social media. Indonesia is probably one of the best places in the world to study content of social media. Jakarta produces more tweets than any other city in existence today. So we've seen some very interesting work in that area. In poverty, mobile carriers, for example, tell us that they can predict with 90% accuracy your household income simply by the frequency and amount by which you top off your airtime on your mobile phones. And we did a project last year where we found that by looking at work-related conversation online through blogs and forums in the U.S. and Ireland, we were able to predict unemployment spikes because people know something's wrong at the office, and in the months before they lose their jobs, they talk about work differently.
Very interesting. You mentioned Indonesia, and you mentioned Ireland and the U.S., and all of these countries have a very high internet penetration rate. I'm wondering, what about least developed countries and countries without significant internet access? What kind of approach is needed there? And can mobile phones fill the gap, or is something more than that needed?
Well, I think there are two points here. One, we're trying to develop now the beginnings of what will be a toolkit for a post-2015 world. So this is a forward-looking R&D initiative. We recognize that the digital divide is far from closed, but it's going to take time to do this research and learn how to use these different kinds of data. We want to be ready as internet access and as smartphones and as social media penetrate into populations where it's unimaginable that it would be available today. But that said, yes, it's astonishing what you can do with mobile phones. You know, the work that already is happening in the private sector in the mobile industry is a testament to how powerful that analysis is. Even if you're looking at purely anonymized data on the use of mobile phones, carriers can predict your age to within, in some cases, plus or minus 1 year with over 70% accuracy. They can predict your gender with between 70 and 80% accuracy. One carrier in Indonesia told us they can tell what your religion is by how you use your phone. You can see the population moving around. Now think about this. This is astonishing. The ability to see in real time where beneficiaries are can allow us to understand exactly where the population is that we need to reach. And if you combine that with information on the size of airtime purchases, you can tell how much money these people have. You start to be able to extract basic demographic information, population movement, and behavior data from this information while fully protecting privacy in the process. What we're focused on now is working with mobile carriers around the world, including in Indonesia, to get access to archives of anonymized call records and purchase records. Because what we do is essentially correlate that data with official statistics. You look at the movement patterns, the mobile service consumption patterns, the social network patterns that you can derive from how people interact, and compare that to food prices, fuel prices, unemployment rates, disease outbreaks, earthquakes, and look at, you know, how a population was affected. Or you compare it to when a program was initiated in the field or when a policy initiative got off the ground. Did it actually work? The potential for monitoring and evaluation here as well is quite remarkable.
A lot of the UN system is also dedicated to conflict prevention, as we know. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the role that you see for big data in conflict prevention. Could real-time data be used to examine, for example, behavioral changes in a group or a population that could in turn lead to violence? And what role do you see for the Global Pulse in assisting UN agencies involved in conflict prevention?
Conflict prevention isn't an area that we've looked at to date. I think there are two possible tracks one could pursue here. One is simply understanding the precursors. If we go back and look at historical situations where conflict emerged within a population, being able to use the archive of digital data and the actual historical record that was collected on the ground through practitioners and doing, again, these correlation studies could be very interesting for being able to understand what the precursors were, what the early warning signs were in the digital world that no one was listening for. So I do think it would be potentially a fruitful direction. At the same time, there is already some research going on in the U.S. and other countries looking at discrimination and looking at hate speech, for example, and ways that you can quantify and geographically place those kinds of conversations through social media. So I think the potential is there. It's not something we've explored to date, but the signals are probably out there.
To what extent is all of this reliant on large multinational corporations sharing the data? I'm thinking, for example, of the mobile phone companies in particular, or, you know, using data that a company like Google might have. Is the Global Pulse working with companies like these, and how willing are they to share, and with whom are they willing to share?
So we've recognized from the start that while there's a wealth of information available publicly, tremendous amount is being collected behind firewalls and is not publicly shared. We started approaching companies about a year ago around this concept we call data philanthropy, which is essentially a vision of companies that have this very valuable data, sharing it in ways that don't compromise the privacy of their customers, don't compromise their own competitiveness in the market, and yet could be used by development to understand what's happening while it's still happening. The response has been overwhelming and surprising. The companies don't actually view this as simply a form of corporate social responsibility. We thought data philanthropy, it's a new form of giving. But actually what they see is an opportunity to mitigate business risk. Because if you're operating in an emerging market where you're counting on a population to be able to afford your goods and services over the long haul, and they fall back into poverty due to exogenous shocks, and it was your data all along that could have alerted policymakers earlier in ways that could let them adjust social protection and make other interventions, there go your customer base, right? There is your opportunity. And the possibility of actually buying what you might call business risk insurance through data is pretty appealing.
There are clearly a lot of benefits that could be had by using this kind of data for timelier insights into what communities are experiencing, and then in turn for better informed interventions. But what are the risks? What do you see as the big challenges that remain? And given these constraints, how do you expect, or rather, what do you expect Global Pulse to achieve in the coming years? Do you have a specific goal that you're working towards?
We do. I think, you know, one of the fundamental challenges with big data and global development is a challenge that's simply intrinsic to all data. Validation, verification, how do you use it? How do you handle the volume of data? How do you know where there is causality and where there isn't? And this is an area where a lot of research is needed. So this is where we're focused, really, is kind of separating out where there are real opportunities and understanding what data sources contain genuine signals, how do you identify them, what technologies do we need, how do we find ways to make those affordable, how can open source software help? So the basic challenge of working with the data is there. At the same time, you have data privacy. I mean, this is, I think if we look at the big data phenomenon, it's probably the single biggest human rights issue we're going to see over the next decade because of the power to re-identify people when they thought they were anonymized by bringing together these different data sets. Now, the private sector looks at big data and they see privacy risk. But at the UN, we can and must look at big data and see a human rights issue. And we're very concern that at the same time that you see these risks to privacy in big data, there's also this opportunity. Right now, the conversation around big data is very polarized. You might call it Germany versus Mark Zuckerberg, right? You have the very conservative prohibition against reuse without explicit permission that has become pervasive in the European Union. It's a very guarded approach. At the opposite end of the spectrum, you have companies that live on big data, which are saying privacy is dead, profit is king. We're trying to insert a third pole into this debate, which is to say that big data is a raw public good. But to do that, we have to create a kind of R&D sandbox where we can experiment with it and learn how to use it safely.
Thank you very much for your insights. It was fantastic having you at the Global Observatory today.
Thank you.